This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the New Books in Psychoanalysis podcast. I'm Ashish Roy, teaching and practicing psychoanalysis in New Delhi. Today, we will be speaking to Niloufer Kaul, who has taught English literature and now works as a training and supervising analyst in Delhi. She won the Francis Dustin Prize for her paper on parasitism in 2018 and the Rosika Parker Prize for her paper on casual violence in 2021. Today, we are discussing her book, Plato's Ghost, on liminality and minus links in psychoanalysis, which was published by Phoenix Press in 2021. Hi, welcome, Niloufer, to this podcast.
Hi, Ashish. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you so much for doing this and for the introduction.
Niloufer, could we begin with you telling us how you conceived of this book and how you conceived of this title and what all went into it, if you could orient our listeners to that.
Yeah, I must mention that it was not me who conceived of this book, but Dr. Salman Akhtar, who without my knowledge was collecting papers I had written. And he had found me a publisher, Kate Pierce from Phoenix Press. And he had already decided I was going to write a book. I didn't think I had a book in me at all, but I was very moved. And then I stared at my papers and I wondered what they had in common with each other. And what I came up with was the idea of in-betweenness, of the slippery space in between binaries. And that was really what drew me to psychoanalysis in the first place. But as I began to think of this liminal space, I thought of all kinds of things that happened there. I thought of Avner's deeply moving paper on transcending the caesura. And then I thought of all kinds of things that go wrong in that space. Behn puts forward different models of the mind, the digestive model, the respiratory model, and the synaptic model. In the last, the synaptic model, he suggests that the analytic space could be thought of as the meeting of two minds, much like the synaptic region where nerve endings meet. This space is the space of turbulence and can beget all kinds of links. There are stormy encounters that may lead to growth, but as you see in my cover image of the book, they can also move towards a negative grid. Minus versions of truth and knowledge. Unfortunately, the analyst may remain oblivious all too often. So we make dutiful responses, for instance, or we talk about our concern or our protectiveness, but I believe these form the patina, that is the negative of love, hate, and knowledge. I offer the word mutter, M-U-R-T-Y-R, as a kind of minus link. So it's, if you like, a combination of martyr and mother as a kind of a negative version of the analyst. Because we cannot overvalue empathy without the lived emotional experience, the kindness becomes spurious. So those were some of the thoughts that brought it together. The title that you mentioned is from a piece I'd written for Dr. Akhtar's book on regret. And I had used one of his papers to anchor a part of the argument there. This is a paper by him called Someday and If Only Fantasies. So he says that there are two kinds of narcissistic longings, one which is posited in the future, someday this will happen, or the past, where you're looking back and saying, if only this would this could have happened. So when I was reading that, I thought of a poem that I'd read in college by the poet Yeats called What Then? And I added that as a third concept to Salman's concept. And I wrote, the name of the paper was Plato's Ghost. So it kind of stayed with me. And I meant it to be a kind of title that everyone could bring their associations to. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Thank you for sharing this entire journey. That's very interesting. I found that your book really draws a lot from philosophy, from literature, and psychoanalysis. Could you share something about how all three of them come together in your way of thinking?
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't know why you say philosophy, because while it's very flattering to me that you think so, I don't actually claim to know very much philosophy. Perhaps what you're talking about is literary theory. And that's something that literature kind of steered me towards. It's become now impossible to read and study in departments of literature without confronting this behemoth, you know, of critical theory, literary theory, and which has obviously a long tradition in philosophy. So perhaps that is what makes you feel that there is philosophy in my book. But as for literature, I think literature is and will always be my first love. And what I perhaps cherish the most about literature is that it deepens my relationship with reading itself. And it is in and through literature that I discovered psychoanalysis. So it was never like I was drawing upon different things, but that it was always very organically linked. I first encountered Freud while teaching. I taught Freud. So, yeah.
Coming to the central theme of your work, which is on minus links, could you share how in the clinic these minus links are observed and felt?
Yeah, that's actually the big question. I'll see how I can perhaps, like I mentioned right in the beginning of our conversation, I think what interests me the most is how the analyst, I think now increasingly we find that we need to focus on the link between the patient and us. And that this link, when it is forged in a way that is truthful, it can move the link itself towards growth, but that all too often we find that our minds, and I'm talking here about the analyst's mind is saturated, exhausted, overrun with all kinds of feelings and unprocessed thoughts. And what the analyst then tends to do is takes recourse to mechanical interpretations, to ready-made responses, to ideas of how an analyst is supposed to be, and leans on theoretical concepts, for example, rather than towards an unsaturated experience. And I feel that over time, if we are not careful, the whole relationship becomes crowded and overrun by untruthful communication. So I don't know if this answers your question, but it's hard for me to perhaps summarize the whole book. Yeah.
It's also something which is so dense and so difficult to actually capture. And your book does it in so many vivid ways. I was also thinking if you could share about some of the theoretical antecedents that help you create a canvas for this idea of minus links.
I don't know. I guess it would have to begin with Bien. Meltzer writes very eloquently about it. Meg Harris-Williams, Avner Bergstein, and Civita Rise, Antonio Ferro. These are some of the people I have read who've written, Susan Mayo, who have written a lot on the nature of the link, the caesura, and who've elaborated Bien's ideas. There are plenty others, but yeah.
There is one chapter in your book which is dedicated to language, and it talks about how language can be a form of collusion,
mm-hmm.
which gets oversaturated.
Mm.
Could you share more about this phenomena, and also how are analysts supposed to work with it, with this oversaturation and predetermination of what is happening in the clinical setting?
Well, so I think I would have to give at least two-part answer to it. And I think one is that what is the patient bringing to us? And I think what the patient is bringing to us is a particular kind of organized narrative very often. So the patient comes to the analyst with certain assumptions that that you go for analysis to discuss problems, or you go there to say things that you can't say anywhere else, or you go there to impress the analyst, or you go there to prove that you're worthy of an analysis. Now, I think all these assumptions are actually never verbalized by the patient. And I think Meltzer calls this the gathering of the transference. That is to say, the analyst has to be aware that above and beyond what the patient is actually saying in so many words, there is a whole series of assumptions which perhaps the patient has not verbalized even for herself or himself, right? So we have to listen not just to the words that the patient is bringing, but also to what assumptions are behind those words. Why is this patient telling me a dream? Why is this patient only telling me repetitively about how stuck her marriage feels? You know, so that's one part of the answer. The other is that what responses do we give to the patient? Do we feel obliged to respond to them again? To the verbal part of the communication of the patient, in which case are we going to collude with the patient in joining in with the stuckness that they are already talking about? Or are we able to find through language another vertex, as Bien says, from where we can look at the material that the patient is bringing to us? Because the material is not just the spoken material, but it is the body, it is in the gestures, it is in the way that they lie on the couch. All of these are a part of the communication, which if we listen to with an evenly suspended attention, then I think what comes out of us may not be as tired, as predictable. So,
connected to what you just said, towards the end of your book, you talk about how we can often be overindulgent in our reveries. And you stress on paying attention to free association and holding it. Say a little about that, since reveries are something which have been quote unquote fashionable, also deeply transformative. How is your own analytic experience of using reveries and also going beyond them? If you could say a little about that.
Yeah. I think I have a certain impatience with any kind of idiom that gets overused. So I feel that whichever school of analysis you're coming from, some terms become, as you said rightly, fashionable. So, you know, if you come from this school, then enactment is fashionable. From come from that school, reverie is fashionable, you know. And I feel that, you know, that it gets very overused. And it requires a lot of skill and thought to be able to use your associations, whatever they happen to be, your dreams, your reveries, whatever it is. If you ask me personally, I use them all the time. I mean, I would... It's the only way to find one's way out of the deadness, the stuckness, etc., that we feel. But do I call them reveries? I'm never sure. I'm never sure. Was this a reverie? Was this an association? Was this a kind of waking dream? I don't know. But I think it's very important not to jump and say, oh, I had this reverie, because very often we find in supervisions and so on, maybe even ourselves, having disconnected thoughts. And I think it's, and I'm not saying that they are not useful or that they can't be used, but I think very often people of all of us are not aware of why we are having these thoughts and in what way we can use them in the service of the patient. So it's not a thing in itself, is what I'm saying. A reverie is not, just because I have a thought doesn't mean anything until I'm able to give it some meaning in the light of what is happening in the session. And hence a certain kind of wariness with the popularity of the word?
I don't know, but I think somewhere maybe when you use the word overindulgence, it's also to make analysts aware that don't become narcissistic with what is going on inside you, but always be open to questioning it, like you have just shared.
Yeah, thanks for picking that up. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think there are so many different themes that your book picks up, but I really found that the link that you make between perversion and parasitism was deeply interesting. And since you have worked on the idea of parasitism for some time, if you could tell us a little about how it makes an appearance and how you work with it.
I think it came to me perhaps because of a certain kind of an unpleasant sensation I had working with a few patients, where I would feel that something was being taken from me, but it was not being acknowledged. And to be honest, it's not something which is experienced only with patients, but it's something one experiences in life itself, that when something is taken from us and not acknowledged, it creates a kind of a resentment. And that was the kind of starting point for the paper, where I tried to make sense of it, that why should it be something that a patient doesn't want to acknowledge? You know, it could be a book, it could be your way of dressing, it could be your way of speaking. And you feel that it's something that is being, I thought to begin with, that it was something that was being, I felt like it's being stolen from me. So that's why the word parasitic came into my mind. But as I wrote the paper and as I began to understand it, I thought it wasn't the patient who was being parasitic, but it was the link which felt parasitic, where it really came back to me and my inability to be able to see and understand what was actually happening. And it is when you reach that kind of block in yourself, where you are not able to make sense of why somebody is making you feel this way, that the paper actually became about an autistic island. That it is when these two blocks collide with each other. Patient naturally, by virtue of being a patient, is helpless in being able to communicate what is going on. But if I too fail to pick it up, then we keep colliding like these two, you know, rocks against each other. And it remains at the level of parasitism. Whereas in fact, if I'm able to read what is happening, like the helplessness. And that's why I give those instances of, in plant, in animal life, that what is parasitic from one vertex is commensal from another. So it's really analytic failure that pointed me or kept me at the level of reading it as parasitism. But writing the paper actually opened up something that was blocked.
So interesting that autism, parasitism, and perversion, parasitism and perversion have a kind of a enmeshment of boundaries in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Autism, as you just said, is like an island.
Mm.
So I'm wondering that how does one observe these forms being different and being enmeshed or coexisting together in clinical work?
Yeah.
Especially, and parasitism, how do we see the difference or the link between in these two?
Okay, so well, in a very straightforward and simple way, a parasitic link is a hostile link, or it's experienced as a hostile link, and therefore it is the opposite of hospitable, you know. It's interested in taking, but for some tragic reason, this cannot be acknowledged. And so it is, what is being given is not, it is ingested, but it's not digested, I feel. So it's taken in. So what is then taken in is denuded of its power to nourish. So what is given then in such a link doesn't have the power to nourish. Say a mother who is very resentful of feeding the baby at her breast is feeding it in a form where she's rejecting it. The baby is not really able to derive nourishment from that feed. So we may see patients who receive, but in a very stealthy way. You know, they may dress like you, they may speak like you, but this is never brought into the session. For example, a patient of mine who said, I'm interested only in taking what you don't intend to give. Now, this perverts the relationship between the giver and the taker. Literally, the word perverse comes from the Latin to thoroughly turn, you know. So the parasitic link thoroughly turns around the possibility of a commensal or a symbiotic link between the giver mother and the taker baby. The analyst and analysand may enter into a perverse link where they are each taking from one another without being able to acknowledge it to themselves. And, you know, when I wrote this paper, I didn't think of it, but I thought later that maybe we as analysts also are parasitically taking things from our patients. In fact, we probably do and never acknowledge it. And then we tell ourselves, like, we have to maintain neutrality. We have to maintain abstinence. That's why we can't acknowledge things to our patients. But nevertheless, it means that it is a parasitic link that we are colluding with. So, yeah.
That's so interesting. And trying to imagine, what do we take from our patients?
I think we take a lot, no? I mean, it can be very concretely, like in the sense of maybe a book or a poem or something that they talk about. It can be their way of thinking, which is very interesting to us. Sometimes they give us ideas which we hadn't had before. We write papers on them. They give us themselves to write about. So, yeah.
You also write in one part of your book that how autistic retreats should be respected. I'm wondering that how do you position autistic retreats in normal development, and how should they be respected?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose retreat is really the crucial word, right? In this, because we are not here talking about autism, but we are talking about retreats. And the most recent example that comes to my mind is COVID. You know, when COVID happened, I think most people, I mean, including myself probably, went into a kind of an autistic shell, you know, from which it was quite difficult to reemerge. Not that we enjoyed being inside it, but that we did exactly what, you know, crustaceans do. We created, our homes became our shells, and we were, you know, inside that, and we were operating on our computers, and we were, you know, so the whole internet, for example, the phenomena of internet and Zoom analysis all feeds into an autistic retreat. So do we respect that? I don't think there can be a categorical yes or no answer to that. And I think with patients, we have to always keep interpreting and thinking about the role of the retreat in that particular moment. Is it something, because, you know, if we don't talk about it, if we just leave it be, then we are deepening the shell. If we are very proactive in it, then we are probably strengthening the fear of intrusiveness that the patient is feeling. So I guess that's why I say it can't be a yes or no answer. It has to be like an analysis. There are no answers, right? So we just have to take each moment as it comes and see what the experience of that moment is. What could the patient be meaning in that moment by his retreat?
Another one of your chapters focuses on Meltzer's ideas, and the chapter is very evocatively titled The Womb and the Fetus.
Mm-hmm.
Really helps us see where the struggle lies when the analyst is trying to care for the patient, but the patient can't take in care. You also really focus on the bodily zones as geographical locations where the patient is housed. Could you share something about this experience of observing these bodily zones in the clinical work and expressing it to the patient? And what does it mean in terms of the psychic structure of the patient or the psychopathology?
I'm not sure that I see patients like Meltzer describes them as being in particular bodily zones, the breast or the genitals or the anus. It's a very persuasive reading, but I'm not sure that I would like to classify patients in those terms. But I do feel that there are patients who may be very stuck inside one way of functioning. And perhaps the only way is to observe how claustrophobic, how paralyzing that is. But also to pick up in the experience of being in the session any moment that feels alive. And one has to, I like the way, you know, you had mentioned the word hospice. So I like the way you use that. One has to be prepared for a long hospice oneself, and perhaps the possibility of things not significantly changing, and that despair has to be borne. So it's like, you know, with one ear, you hear the claustrophobia and the paralysis, and with the other ear, you are listening for any tiny movement that is venturing out of it. That's, I thought, the best that I can.
That's beautifully put. Thank you. I also wanted to know from you that you write a lot about working with patients whose psychic skin hasn't developed. And I was wondering if you could shed some light on the counter-transference responses that an analyst feels, and what is the kind of fragility that patients who don't have a psychic skin What is the underlying fragility that they carry?
It's come a long way from the time they wrote about thin-skinned and thick-skinned narcissism. And I have in mind Esther Vick's work on the function of skin in early object relations. And in fact, I was rereading that paper today itself. And I was, because I am actually working again on the same, on a related subject. And I found that when she's describing the second skin formation, it sounds very much like how we look at autistic babies, you know, very much the fears that are described are of unintegration rather than disintegration, you know, of falling into space, of leaking, of dissolving, of and those call to us in many different ways, actually. Sometimes we can feel maternal. We can feel the need to envelop such patients. We can lend them our own skin, again, unconsciously, so that they can wrap themselves in our skin. So we become the womb to the fetus. At other times, it can be a very anti-experience where we don't want to lend our skin to, where the patient is being too needy and is experienced by the analyst as being invasive or intrusive. We may not wish to lend our skin. We may retreat away from the patient. So I guess it's a bit of a dance, isn't it? Where we don't quite know what it's going to evoke in us. So it's not as if patients who don't have skin have only one way of behaving and the analyst has only one response to that. But that each analyst, in each session does a different dance, you know, where we don't know whether we are going to feel for the patient or feel against the patient, keeps changing. I don't know if I answered your question.
Maybe it would be really nice to hear something that you really like from your book, if you could read it out to our listeners.
Thanks, Ashish. Maybe I'd like to read the last paragraph because we are concluding the interview. So it might give it a sense of an ending. This book started out as an exploration of the liminal spaces that constitute the domain of psychoanalysis, but eventually it began to narrow down to the impediments, roadblocks, bastions, and walls that emerge in the analytic link. It seems that the primitive part of the mind is always looking for ways to evade psychic pain, and emotional truth is always in peril. The links between us and our patients, and more importantly, within us ourselves, are always fraught with danger. All too often, omniscience and arrogance threaten knowledge. Melancholia poses as grief, adhesiveness as introjection. Sentimentality and nostalgia replace emotionality. Horror takes over terror, while sensationalism robs mysteriousness. Romantic love acts as an alibi for terrifying intimacy. Empathy conceals deadness. Obsequiousness sounds like gratitude. Collusions and folly are the dissemble as mutualism. In these liminal moments, the links between analyst and analysand slide away from the emotional truth rather than towards it.
Thank you. That's a beautiful ending. And thank you so much for...
Thank you so much, Ashish, for doing this.